Let's take several questions here, and please introduce yourself.
Irina, may I ask first? Yeah. I'm sorry you haven't answered
you have to introduce the, yourself.
You have not. My name is Nenad Vejic, I'm associate director. You have not answered to the question put by Roman. Roman asked you, will Europe stick to it? You said Czech Republic will stick to it.
Speak for Europe now.
We do speak for Europe at the moment, at least till June 30th. And I think after us comes Sweden, which has the same commitment to Ukraine's independence. And as for Europe, I think Europeans are prepared to help out those who want to help themselves. And many of us in Europe had been frustrated in the last few years by what happened in Ukraine after the Orange Revolution. If we see a profound, real interest, we will help. If we don't, we will just move on elsewhere.
Okay, we have a question here, Sergey, please.
Sergey Sinitsky from Russian Service Community. Mr. Ambassador, let me please return the chip once again to the Russian gas delivery through Ukraine to the EU. Any gas, any natural gas being extracted, should be delivered somewhere, either to consumer or to some underground reserve, gas holder or reserves. 3 years ago, when we were speaking about the first Ukrainian-Russian gas war, so-called, it lasted only 3 or 4 days.
4 days.
4 days. One of the main reasons was the Russian filled all practically affordable gas reserve, gas holders underground within 3 or 4 days. And that was one of the main reasons why Gazprom just has to resume delivery. From this point of view, what do you think about the main reason why the latest conflict, I mean this year, could last for 3 weeks?
Well, both were ready to go on for a long time. Ukraine is ready to go to the summer. They had storages full, they cut off the country completely. As for Russians, they could go on for a long time as well, because in the end, you can do the third thing with the gas, which is burn it. You can flare it, which is being done on a tremendous scale in Russia. I mean, the amount of gas burned, or flared, as it's being called in Russia, is probably about one-third of the whole volume of gas which is being delivered to Europe. Annually, I mean, talking about normal year. Flaring is still, I was in Khanty-Mansiysk in October last year. I've been to many places before. And landing at night in those places is really, Las Vegas multiplied by 10. It's really a flash show. So there is no problem with this. You can just flare, you can just burn the gas. You can do that. That's quite feasible. And I think what was really at stake this January was that Russia was really economically hurt by the lost revenues. And the possibility of this standoff lasting to the summer, because Ukraine's storages were full, they could keep the country going until June, July, they would basically take away a huge slice of Russia's foreign currency revenues. And in the time of crisis, that would be a major blow. So what we feared actually was the possibility that if the conflict would last 2-3 months, you could see a very violent reaction, because it would be a major, major blow to Russia's economy. So the gas issue as such wasn't really, in my opinion, the major problem. The major problem was, what would Russia do if it had basically no or very little income from the gas for 3 months?
Bruce, please.
Sure. Bruce Panarin from the Central Newsroom at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. You were talking about choices, Ambassador, and giving the power to the consumers, taking it away from the suppliers. Yet, in fact, Europe right now has pretty limited choices. Of all the projects that are proposed to bring more gas to Europe, the European Union, Nord Stream is the only one that's really under construction and is coming up in 2011. It's Russian gas. South Stream, of course, is Russian gas. Even an expansion of the existing Ukrainian pipeline network also presumes that you'll be pumping Russian gas through that. Now, there are some projects that the European Union has given some support to, Nabucco, White Stream. These presume that you'll be able to get gas from the Caspian region, and in Nabucco's case, probably Iran. So my question is, looking at it from the European Union's point of view, how possible is it to avoid Russian gas when, in fact, it seems like the European Union is currently increasing the amount of Russian gas it's getting and increasing projects that are bringing Russian gas? And is it an acceptable substitute to try to find supplier countries in the Caspian region and Iran, which might not be any better of a partner for the European Union than Russia is?
Well, once again, I will return to what I said earlier about the investment done. You know, Britain has built terminals for 40 billion cubic meters of gas coming in the form of LNG, which is actually a much bigger amount than Nabucco proposed, because the second stage of Nabucco is 30 BCM. The first phase is just 6 BCM, which is 6 billion cubic meters, which is less than the Czech consumption. So Britain has done it quietly and is now importing liquefied natural gas from Qatar, Trinidad, Nigeria, Algeria, you name it. That's actually the freedom which I think we should be looking at. For me, I must say that the fixed pipelines do not really bring much hope into my mind, because replacing Russia with Turkmenistan or Iran, replacing Ukraine with Turkey, doesn't really fundamentally change your situation. I do believe that LNG brings the freedom. It's still slightly more expensive than the piped gas, but at the same time, I really believe that there is a price for freedom of movement, and I like that. So I do think that for Europe, LNG is something that should be looking at very much more carefully. And then again, you see the difference that France, Spain, Britain, Netherlands, Italy, even Greece already have terminals or are building them, while in this part of Europe, only Poland is talking about building one. That's been a shift.
So if I could ask a follow-up question, then you seem to be advocating the construction of more of these LNG facilities and stuff, but that would also require a whole new pipeline infrastructure from the port countries that are receiving this, which is also a huge amount of money.
Well, once again, it's actually an interesting thing. What we really need in Europe are interconnections between countries. And then you're sometimes really surprised by how little is needed. The interconnection between Poland and Czech Republic, all that is needed is 10 kilometers of pipe. That's not much. In case of this January, when we wanted to help Slovakia to actually get some gas to Slovakia from Czech Republic, we were told by the companies around the Slovak system that it would take weeks to change because if something was needed, a switch and la la la. In the end, the whole operation took 3 hours. It was possible. Many things are possible. Once you start talking about really connecting European countries, you will immediately run into the incumbents, the companies which at the moment control much of the market, which are not always ecstatic from the possibility of having to compete for what they already have. But if somebody scares you with billions needed to build European interconnections, it's, excuse me, bullshit. I mean, the cost...
Oh, John,
no. No, please do so.
Government already fell.
No, please do so. I'm not very much... I'm not very polite, but the basic rule for medium-pressure pipelines or even the high-pressure pipelines is 1 kilometer is about 1.5 million euros, approximately. So the connection with Poland would be about 15 million euros. The connection needed for Bulgaria, which is to get actually piped gas from the LNG terminal in Greece, which is supposed to be built in northern Greece, is about 30 kilometers needed. It's 45 million euros. I know it's a lot of money. I don't have that money myself. But I think for governments, those money are really pocket money. And all that is needed is actually political will, because, of course, the first thing you encounter once you decide that you will build it, those interconnections, is that somebody will say, well, but not in my backyard, not through my garden, not around my city. That's actually the bigger problem in Europe now. That's actually one of the reasons why so much money from the EU package, which was agreed on last week, in the end will not be used. Because the proviso in the spending package is that the money will be used in 2009, 2010. And trust me, we will not be able to spend much of that money. because programs and projects in Europe take long. I mean, usually take years and years. We built a pipeline from Germany in 18 months, but all the legal work before that took almost 4 years. And that was with excellent help from German government and the Bavarian government, in huge cooperation with them. And still, it was 4 years of legal battles with owner of that plot of land and that plot of land. So that will be the bigger problem. It's not so much the money itself. It's more the political will, which you need. You have to go to the village somewhere near the border and say, well, excuse me, but we need a pipeline, and it has to go through the region and near your village. And you have to have the bollocks to go there and say this, which is unpleasant, unpopular, and it doesn't get you any points in next elections. That's the real story.
Ambassador Bartuszka, are you with me?
Yeah.
I'm Alan Davidov, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, correspondent in Washington, D.C. Ambassador Bartuszka, once you said that the biggest threat for the European energy security came not from the political pressure from Russia, but from the present condition of Russian gas fields. The idea was that if no investments come at the moment, Russia will be unable to fulfill its obligations to European Union as early as by the year 2014. There simply will not be enough gas. And if this was just an assumption, how do you think, Ambassador, whether or not in reality Russia is able to provide fulfillment of its obligations to EU after the year 2014? Thank you.
Well, I do believe that this is really the elephant in the room, that Russia at the moment basically uses, for much of its production, 2 megafields, Yamburg and Urengoy, each of them being bigger than many countries' supplies. But in the same time, those fields have been tapped since the 70s and 80s. And they will last years still. But if we want to have gas coming from Russia in 2020, and if Russia wants to fulfill its commitments and to supply its own country and growing needs in Russia, it will need to open up new fields. Probably those will be Yamal and Shtokman. The Shtokman is the underground one in Barents Sea. Yamal is quite inhospitable place in northern Russia. And both of those projects are very costly. And whenever I speak to Miller, the head of Gazprom, or Medvedev or others, this is really the touchiest subject because, and I think this is the reason why Russia reacts so, well, emotionally, I would say, emotionally, to all the dealings with Ukraine and the transit, is that in their own reckoning, to open up Yamal, the investment needed is about $80 billion, 80. For Shtokman, it's about $60 billion, 60. That's their own numbers. I have no second guess on that. But even if it's only $80 and $60 billion, you need your customers for at least 20, 30 years to get the money back. And Russia at the moment is heavily trying to find out how serious and sincere we are as Europeans in our gas demands towards Russia. Because they don't want to be in the situation that they will open up those fields with such huge heavy investments only to see us going away from them to LNG or other source of gas or other source of energy. So what you have in the moment is actually a very difficult moment in Moscow. And every time I do meet Russian leaders, they keep asking me, are you sincere? Do you really need the gas or not? And I would think that some clarity from us, from Europe, would be also in order. Because we do have very competing and confusing messages to all the producers. Somehow similar to the US position towards, let's say, Saudi Arabia, which is, we want to get away from Middle Eastern oil, and then you go to Saudi Arabia and ask them to please open up the new field. We do the same in Russia. We preach the more effectiveness
using less energy, cutting our energy needs. And then you go to Moscow and keep asking, how about Yamal? How about Shtokman? Are you going to open it soon? Well, that doesn't make sense. So Russia keeps talking about how they see energy security, which for them means the security of the supplier, which I understand. I mean, they will have to, in the end, put huge amounts of money on the ground, hoping to recoup the money in decades afterwards. And some fragments from us would be in order. This is the reason why Russia purchases wants so much to have the long-term contracts. In the same time, we all know that contracts are only worth if there is a goodwill behind them. You can always declare force majeure and go away. So I don't know if it will be 2014, because that was, you know, that was my prediction before the crisis hit. At the moment, it will be probably slightly more farther ahead. But there is a moment which is before the end of next decade, when much of the present gas fields will be nearing the extinction. And the growing consumption in Russia, and the fact that Russia, even with all the new nuclear power plants, will still make most of its electricity from gas. At the moment, it's 65% of Russia electricity is from natural gas. Now, that will keep huge demand inside Russia. Russia is growing, well, not so fast this time, but it will be growing again after the crisis is over. It will need more and more its own resources for its own growth. And we will hopefully return to growth as well in Europe. So you will see. I'm quite skeptical at the moment whether Russia will really step up the investment, because the situation is complicated there, and economically as well.
Let me ask Ambassador Smith or Mr. Kupchinski if they have any comments on this issue.
Well, I think obviously that the with the downturn in the economy, it's going to extend the time that Russia will be able to supply Europe. But I'd like, quite frankly, while there should be some stability in demand on the part of Europeans, I wouldn't want Russia to have too much security when it comes to it. Because there are, I think the Brits, you're right, you're pointing out the LNG factor with the Brits. But I'd like to kind of, if I can be non-diplomatic, take a little issue with Ambassador Bartuszka, who to me sounds more like old Europe than new Europe. And I think you put too much blame on the Central Europeans, who were in a very different situation than the Czech Republic. Having spent a lot of time in the area, I think that first it's the timing of their developments, the way they were tied to Russia economically was very different. Also, I think you give too much credit to the West Europeans for their self-interest. I think a lot of the energy policies in Western Europe come from, quite frankly, companies or individuals who are going to benefit financially from their ties with the Russians. I think the circumstance of Mr. Schroeder, the friends of Mr. Berlusconi, there are people, there are Austrian banks who have benefited enormously. Now, the question is that in Europe's interest? Is that in their own country's interest? I would kind of take issue with some of that, because I think that, quite frankly, it may be in their personal interest, but is it the interest of their country to pay an enormous price for natural gas, which is arbitrarily set by Russia? And it's not even Russian gas. It's mostly gas from Central Asia. But the fact that the West Europeans, have paid that high price, to me, doesn't show that they're the smart ones and the people in East Central Europe are the dumb ones, because they haven't invested in large amounts of infrastructure so far. I think the situation of the Czech Republic is quite different from many of the countries of Central Europe.
Okay, may I?
Absolutely.
Oh, well, you know, I'm saying this for one reason. We want to have a united front in Europe, and it cannot start from the Eastern European part saying, well, we want the EU money for this. We will never get French or German support for that. We can get German and French support, as we did get this January, when we say, well, we understand we also have to put money at ourselves. And then you can actually get those countries on board. And you know, if I sound like old Europe, I'm sorry, I'm not. I'm very much the new one. But you know, it's been three months now when I'm trying to actually have some sort of agreement among EU27. And quite frankly, this agreement will either be the one which the French and Germans can live with, or there will be none. That's it. That's a very simple thing. You have something to it.
Irina?
Roman? Okay. Yes, Roman?
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the United States and its dependence on Saudi Arabia, for example. Somebody once said that Russia is a Saudi Arabia with trees. But with the European demand for Russian gas in February of this year, the European demand for Russian gas was down 40% from last year, in the same period last year. Gazprom is caught in a very dangerous cash flow situation. It has warned already that it will be cutting back its desperately needed investment programs into new gas fields exploration. I think this January's boycott ended when it did, because Russia was beginning to close gas fields. They had to. They did not expand flaring. Had they begun expanding the flaring of gas, this would have immediately been picked up by satellite that there was a significant increase. They would have had to flare billions of cubic meters, and that would have immediately showed up, and it did not. And yet, Gazprom, which is faced in April with debts due to European banks are coming up. Will they be able to pay? Will the government give it money? What's going to happen? And all doesn't seem to matter for Gazprom, because they continue to build their new skyscraper in St. Petersburg. They keep funding football clubs. They're buying from Italy the 20% of Gazprom Neft in April for $2.1 billion. Gazprom is not being run as a gas company. It was a gas company until Putin was elected. Gas professionals, gazoviki, were working there, and they understood the nature of the business. Today, you have Alexei Miller, had no background in gas. When Putin came in, brought him in because he was a comrade in the St. Petersburg mayor's office with him. You have Valery Golubyov, former KGB officer, who is one of the deputy CEOs, co-director of Rosukhoenergo, Chuichenko, former KGB officer in charge of the Gazprom legal department. It stopped being a gas company. It became a geopolitical vehicle for Russia. And this is what's sad. That's why we've seen that, and I have documents from Gazprom arguments between the former leadership saying we have to invest money into these new fields, and the new men, Alexander Medvedev, for example, who is purely a money manager, one of the co-directors of Rosukhoenergo, as the head of Gazprom export, competing against himself in stealing gas. That's all it was, stealing money. So how do you deal with a situation like this? How can Putin come up publicly and say, well, we don't know who our partners are in Rosukhoenergo? Alexander Medvedev said, we have no idea who these Ukrainians are. I said, ask Alexander Medvedev. I said, are you serious? This is bullshit, as you understand.
That's contagious, I see.
How is this possible? How do you sign a contract for billions of dollars with people whose names you don't know? And you expect us to believe this? You know, who's been stealing? I mean, everybody, I mean, of course the Ukrainians were stealing. Of course Naftogaz Ukraine, and I know them very well as well. I mean, it's an opaque elephant, you know. It's also being sunk by the Ukrainian government to keep the budget in Ukraine going. It's the only source, real source of revenue that they have. So Yulia Tymoshenko takes money from Naftogaz Ukraine, puts it into the budget, goes to Russia to try to get a $5 billion loan to pay for gas. This is something very wrong with that kind of thinking, with that kind of approach. So again, I ask, but I think it's very important, that if this constant cycle is to be broken, if transparency comes into the gas transportation system into Europe, and you're very right, Ukrtransgaz has to be decoupled from Naftogaz. That's essential. That's one of the major problems always was. Will the European Union not back off? That's my main concern. There will be a salami effect. You know, first Germany, goes out. Then somebody else, the French, the Austrians are vulnerable, the Hungarians. And then you're faced with a situation where nobody's left. The Czechs might be left in there, into that. The Slovaks, of course. The Poles will be supportive. But I'm afraid that if they see that there's a possibility that they will lose the old pricing structure based on oil products, they might back off very quickly and go back to the old formula in order to protect themselves against any uncertainty. And instability plays a major role in the energy business overall. I mean, I'd love for the Slovaks, the Hungarians, and others to have LNG terminals. I would support a project by the EU to build a sea to allow tankers come to the Czech Republic and Slovakia where they could dock. So my question again, will there be political will to bring the Ukrainian pipeline integrated into the European system, kick the Russians back to their borders where they belong and sitting there drinking vodka? And I want to hear your response.
Once again, I do believe Europe will stay with Ukraine as long as Ukrainians themselves are willing to do their bit. And quite frankly, the Ukrainian problem is that there are not that many people in the EU who are still interested in Ukraine. That's mostly in our part of Europe, some people in Berlin and Paris. But for many, Ukraine became totally unpredictable and difficult to understand. And I keep telling my Russian and Ukrainian counterparts, both of them, that they had a beautiful crisis in a bad time. They show they can do tremendous things this January. They were greatly prepared, both of them, Russia and Ukraine. But it was in time when, they will need us, both of them, Ukraine as well as Russia. And they hurt their standing very much this January. So if Ukraine behaves understandably to Europe, I think Europe will remain with Ukraine. If Ukraine reverts to the fratricide, it will just, people will walk away.
Okay, I believe...
Just about this January...
Sorry. I'm sorry. Let's please complete your thought. But I believe we have some questions here in Washington as well.
Okay.
Thank you. My name is Kristina Kushnir, and I'm Ukrainian, and I'm a student at American University here. And I have a question. Basically, this move to modernize Ukrainian gas transportation system was like a move with a horse, if you translate it into a chess game. So I wonder what will be the next steps from European Union. Will this modernization go beyond technical assistance? Will there be some private investments? If so, does European Union expect privatization of the system? So that's one question. And the second question is, will European Union support Ukraine politically and economically in the face of Russia's emotional reaction to the developments. Basically, for example, if Russia is not going to give Ukraine this needed $5 billion loan, will there be any support from European countries? Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, on the agreement reached on Monday, I think that the ball is now in Ukraine in half of the playground. Separation of Ukrtrans gas out of Naftogaz, creation of a clear accounting in the company, and bringing clear projects. That's the condition now, because nobody is going to pour billions of euros for unspecified projects to a bank account which is not clear to whom it belongs. So that's one thing. It's now on Ukrainian side. We hope to see some movement on Ukrainian side soon. We did what we could. As for the political support of Ukraine, I think Ukraine really hurt itself this January. I really think so. And there is precious little support for Ukraine in the EU at the moment. The Czech Republic is probably one of the few last countries in the EU who still care. Am I blunt enough?